You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and I would like to welcome you to this forum on criminal justice reform. And we are webcasting this event live, so a warm welcome to all of our viewers from around the country and also those of you who are watching it live on C-SPAN. So we will be archiving the video for this event, so you'll have an opportunity to view it later if you would like at brookings.edu. We'd also welcome any questions or comments that you have. We've set up a Twitter feed at #CJReform. That's #CJReform. So you're welcome to post any comments that you have during the forum. So the United States has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. Our prisons are overcrowded, and there are racial disparities in convictions and sentencing. We need to reform our criminal justice system and develop alternatives to the existing policies. Today, we're going to be discussing criminal justice reform and how to approach that issue. To help us think about that subject, I am pleased to welcome Governor Terry McAuliffe to Brookings. Many of you know him as the governor of the Commonwealth and a lifelong entrepreneur. He was elected in 2013 and has worked to create jobs and build a 21st century economy. But he also is committed to bettering the lives of ordinary people. After the tragic violence at Charlottesville, he spoke out forcefully against hatred and bigotry. And just over the weekend, he hosted a family day at a juvenile correctional center, which brought together inmates and family members. He's been a trailblazer in restoring civil voting rights for those released from prison. And during his time in office, he has restored voting rights to thousands of ex-felons in Virginia. So please join me in welcoming Governor McAuliffe to the Brookings Institution.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. It's great to be back at the Brookings Institution. Appreciate y'all coming out today. Darrell, I thank you for that introduction. We have some great panelists here with us today, and I appreciate all you're doing. So to all of you, good morning. It's a privilege to be among so many people who share my passion for such an important issue that faces our country. And it's fitting that we're gathered here today on the 54th anniversary of the March on Washington. I first want to recognize the four people who have been very instrumental in working with me today. If they could stand up, my Secretary of Public Safety is here, Brian Moran, my Deputy Secretary, Victoria Cochran, Tracy DeShazer, who is here with us, who is from the Secretary of the Commonwealth, and my Secretary of the Commonwealth is coming, but I don't see her here yet. But these folks have really done a job. Virginia has now led the nation on so many of these very important issues, and I do want to thank the team that we've assembled. 1 month ago, I may have given a very different speech, but today I speak with you with a strengthened resolve of what we've seen over the past several weeks. For many of us, we found it disgusting, deplorable, not acceptable in this great country. We saw hatred, bigotry, and deeply rooted racism on display in Charlottesville and across the nation. The grief and shock at the senseless deaths of Heather Heyer, a 32-year-old woman who was out exercising her constitutional right and was killed by a terrorist driving a car. To the two state troopers in Virginia whom we lost, both individuals very close to me personally, Trooper Burke Bates had been part of my private security detail, my executive protection unit. Lieutenant Cullen had been the pilot of the helicopter that I've flown on for the last 3.5 years. I can tell you, folks, heartbreaking to go visit the families, to see Karen Cullen and her two children, to see Amanda Bates and go visit her at her home and to see her with her two children. Husband not coming home, father not coming home, and to the Heyer family who lost their daughter, our thoughts and condolences to all of them. Also, the swift and unequivocal outpouring of love and solidarity from the vast majority of our citizens. That unabashed and disgusting display that we saw of white supremacists and neo-Nazis and other protests that followed elsewhere was so shocking to so many of us. As I said in Charlottesville that Saturday night, there is no place for Nazis or white supremacists or Klansmen in Virginia. I said on that Saturday evening to get out, to leave our beautiful state. You were not wanted. To go home. Your hatred is not in Virginia. We don't want you in America. These people, as they paraded down our streets, pretended they were patriots. They are not patriots. They are cowards. Patriots are Virginians like Barbara Johns, a 16-year-old woman in Prince Edward County, Virginia, in the 50s. Young African-American girl who walked out and took her class of 400 people and said, "We will not come back until we have equal school facilities." Patriots are the young men and women who wear the cloth of our country to protect those basic freedoms and liberties that we enjoy so much. Charlottesville was a painful and vivid reminder that although we have made significant progress, we still have so much work to do. It is also forcing those whose privilege has allowed them to remain silent, to reconcile two different views of America. Let us be clear. This isn't a debate about monuments. These folks weren't just protesting the name of preserving Southern heritage. They want to maintain inequality in everything that they do, from criminal justice to education to housing, and they want to elevate racism to the highest form. So far, unfortunately, the pendulum has swung in their direction. African Americans, particularly men, are incarcerated at an alarming rate that is disproportionate. African American children are more likely to live and attend school in an area of concentrated poverty. At school, they're disproportionately disciplined and suspended. And they've been the target of legislatures around the country that have pursued policies intended to rob them of their most basic dignity and civic duty, the right to vote. It's no secret that Virginia has adopted and perpetuates some of those same policies and practices. We know that our history is far from perfect in Virginia. But that is exactly why I believe that Virginia should serve as an example to other states looking to take on reform. When I first became governor, it was clear that one place that badly needed attention and resources was our juvenile justice system. We were spending 40% of our funds on just 10% of the youth in our state correction system, and nearly 80% were rearrested within 3 years. To house just one juvenile, it cost Virginia $155,553 per year. And that does not include the educational services, which total $31,644 a year, for a total of $187,000. And yet, 80% were rearrested within 3 years. I was proud to be the first Virginia governor to ever visit one of our juvenile facilities, and in fact, I've now visited both. I had the opportunity to speak with a group of teenage boys at one of Virginia's oversized, maximum security, adult-style facilities. The group asked me, "Why is it, Governor, that the recidivism rate is so high? In fact, the longer that they stayed incarcerated, the more likely they were to reoffend." These boys knew as well as I did that the system was clearly working against them instead of working for them. So I decided to close down both of these outdated institutions and replace them with smaller community-based centers that focus on therapy, training, and education. Today, I am proud to say that our population of incarcerated youth has been cut now by two-thirds, from nearly 600 to just over 200 today. I've directed the millions in savings from this declining institutional population to be reinvested to support the new centers and create an effective statewide system of evidence-based services and supports aimed at preventing incarceration in the first place. To date, I'm proud to say that we have not found any other state that has been able to replicate what we've been able to do in Virginia. I'm proud that we have secured funding that we now offer free travel to families to visit their children. With the new regional options, 75% of our youth will now live within an hour's drive of their family. Today, unfortunately, that number is only 25%. All of these steps will help us strike the right balance between public safety, cost-effectiveness, and rehabilitation. And they support our ultimate goal of giving these kids a shot at a better life when they leave. Just yesterday, as Daryl mentioned, I visited the Bon Air Juvenile Correction Center, one that I'm closing, just outside of Richmond for a family day festival. It was a day for them to celebrate with their families the progress and success that they have had, and to just give them just a couple hours to feel like a regular kid. I was amazed by their incredible talent. One group even performed a spot-on rendition of songs from Hamilton. And we heard moving stories from former incarcerated youth who are now finding tremendous success in their new lives because of the new tools that we've been able to provide them. I met a young man named Jalen who had recently been released from the facility where he had spent the last 5 years of his life. But while some people might see a troubled youth, I saw someone who has the respect and admiration of his peers and his mentors. Jalen is an avid reader and a poet. While incarcerated, he was a mentor at the University of Virginia-led Russia Literature Program and served as the president of the Bon Air Student Association. And now, with 24 college credits already under his belt, he walked out of Bon Air last month with a college acceptance letter in his hand. That's exceptional. Because when I became governor, there were no college courses available to them. Today, these youths are taking up to 7 college courses, including earning their high school diplomas or GEDs and getting now workforce credentials. This marks the first time in Virginia history that such robust educational offerings have been made. That speaks to our dedicated team at the Department of Juvenile Justice and the great educators who work with these youths. While Jalen's story is inspiring, he isn't alone. I believe that each of these young men and women deserve a chance to succeed when they leave the confines of juvenile detention. For our juvenile justice agency, that work starts the moment that they enter our care. But for our education department, for example, that work starts much earlier. Like many states, far too many of our Virginia students spend time outside the classroom as a result of disciplinary action. We've heard of stories of students being handcuffed and arrested, and the data clearly shows that African-American children and students with disabilities are disciplined at a much higher rate. And according to the Virginia Department of Education, African-American students make up 24% of the student population, and yet they account for 53% of the school discipline. And while recent data show a decline in the overall number of suspensions and expulsions, these numbers, folks, are still far too high and continue to disproportionately impact certain students. Totally unacceptable. There is no room in the Commonwealth of Virginia for excessive discriminatory treatment of our students. That is why I announced in October of 2015 a major new statewide initiative, Classrooms, Not Courtrooms. And is why I directed my children's cabinet to reduce the number of students who are referred to law enforcement, experiencing unnecessary school suspensions and expulsions, and suffering under disproportionate disciplinary practices. As a result, our agencies have been hard at work to support the local efforts to stop this practice. In June, we unveiled a new model memorandum of understanding for all of our local partners that all had to sign. And we now have a new rewritten Virginia School Law Enforcement Partnership Guide. There are very strict guidelines now when someone can be disciplined. And I recently signed legislation directing the Virginia Board of Education to establish new alternatives to short-term and long-term suspensions. Together, these steps will contribute to a healthier and more productive learning environment for all of our children, and I hope it will help prevent our young people from entering the juvenile justice system in the first place. These community-focused efforts aren't just important for early intervention and prevention. They are also critical to adults who are re-entering society after they have gone through a period of incarceration. Having a sense of community is critical to making this transition a successful one. We all know that. Just as important, our adult re-entry population needs the skills and preparation to be successful in today's economy. In Virginia, we have taken steps now to offer college credit coursework and career and technical training in all of our facilities. This prepares them for a smooth transition into the new Virginia economy that we've all worked so hard to build. We're proud to have one of the highest numbers of GEDs now among adults in correction facilities, and I am very proud over the last 3 years because of these efforts. Today, Virginia can boast the lowest recidivism rate of any state in the United States of America. These measures point to the success of the historic transformation underway in Virginia, but we cannot stop there. As I alluded to earlier, insidious policies to hamper our citizens, including the lifelong label as a criminal in the name of public safety and justice. The burden of that label can be life-altering after you've served your time. To learn more about that firsthand, I invited 4 Virginians to have dinner with me last week at the governor's mansion. They were students, faith leaders, and professionals. They came from every walk of life. Each had their own unique pathway to success today, but the one common thread among them was their wish not to be defined by a mistake that they had made so many years earlier. That's because each of these Virginians had been convicted of a crime and had all had received a pardon from me. While most had long since moved on from their mistakes that they'd made, one of my guests hadn't even made a mistake in the first place. His name was Robert Paul Davis, and when he was 18 years old, he was wrongly convicted of a double murder after being forced to confess to a crime that he did not commit. On the day I signed his pardon, I ordered his immediate release from prison. He had spent 13 years of his life behind bars. In fact, I've pardoned many Virginians who have never should have been charged in the first place. In May of 2015, I granted an absolute pardon to 58-year-old Michael McAllister, who had been wrongly convicted of attempted rape and abduction of a young mother in Richmond in 1986. After more than 28 years in prison, he was finally exonerated as a true criminal. A serial rapist who bore an uncanny resemblance to Michael came forward and confessed his role. And in March, I just pardoned a group of men known as the Norfolk Four. These 4 Navy veterans were wrongly convicted of raping and murdering a young woman in Norfolk in 1997. Together, they spent years in prison for a crime that they did not commit, after being coerced into falsely admitting guilt by the lead Norfolk police detective on the case. Today, that police investigator is in prison for extortion and lying to the FBI about investigations. Sadly, this decades-long process has irrevocably changed the lives of these 4 men. I cannot give them back those years of their lives. Our system of justice is clearly an imperfect one, which makes the duty and authority to pardon such an important one. But it's not just for people who are wrongly convicted. Also at my dinner with me last week was a 64-year-old reverend, an Army veteran, who unfortunately had been hurt while he was in Vietnam, severely, became addicted to drugs, came home, and at 23 years old was convicted of marijuana conviction and possession. That 40-year-old felony conviction followed him until the day he received a pardon from Maine. It had always bothered him and prevented him from getting certain jobs. Through my pardon power, I made sure that they knew that the Commonwealth of Virginia would never, ever again define these individuals as criminals. While executive clemency is an important power and responsibility of any governor, I've actually taken it to the next step. I've also taken executive action to ban the criminal background check on state job applications, and I've fought to end the ridiculous policy where in Virginia we would strip your driver's license for people who could not pay their court fines and fees. Now, you got court fines and fees, so you take the driver's license away so they can't drive to work to make money to pay the court fines and fees off. Is that not ridiculous? I found this one so baffling. And I reminded our legislators that, you know, there is no metro system in Martinsville, Virginia, or Abington. In our rural communities where this is very prevalent, the only way they can get to work is to drive. So this year, after a long concerted effort, I'm proud that I signed 6 bills that now makes it much more difficult for our courts to suspend driver's licenses and to give drivers a lot more options to get their driver's license back if it is suspended because of an unpaid court fine. In addition, as governor, I've also led the fight these past several years to raise the minimum felony threshold level. I'm embarrassed to say this, but today in Virginia, if you are convicted of stealing anything worth $200 or more, you are now a felon in Virginia for life. If $200 seems low to you, that's because it is. Virginia now ranks 50th out of 50 states, tied with New Jersey. I'll leave that there. Think about it. The $200 floor was first set in 1980, 40 years ago. It means that a kid who just turned 18 or steals a pair of Air Jordans or takes an iPhone is now a felon in Virginia. And that label will be with that individual for the rest of his or her life. You should know that in 1985, it would have been a misdemeanor. So in 2016, I called for raising the minimum felony threshold to $500. Unfortunately, that never even made it out of committee. But if you know anything about me, I was not deterred, so we went back at this year's legislative session, and I propose this modest increase again from $200 to $500. Just to keep up with inflation, that's where it would be. Unfortunately, it was rejected again. Just yesterday, I signed a pardon for a 47-year-old man. His name was Paul, who at 24 stole cash more than $200 from the cash register at the department store where he worked. He had a new baby, he had a broken-down car, and he had no money. Today, he owns a thriving plumbing business, but his felony conviction sometimes prevents him from doing business on any military basis. At Christmas time, he donates free plumbing supplies and services for families in need. Paul was wrong to steal that money, of course, but it doesn't mean that a mistake that he made nearly 25 years ago should follow him forever. In Virginia, that felony conviction also permanently strips you of your civil and voting rights for life, unless restored by a governor. That draconian process was the basis for the most contentious battle I have had as governor. When I came into office, 40 states automatically restored these rights to former felons and gave them an opportunity to have a meaningful second chance with their lives. I set out to bring Virginia into line with the rest of the country. In April 2014, just 3 months after I took office, we made some changes. We shortened the request form from 13 pages to 1, got rid of the notary public, got rid of the waiting period. We streamlined the process so that everybody had the same eligibility requirements. Later, in December 2014, I announced that I had restored the rights of 5,100 Virginians, more than any other governor of Virginia history had done in a year. We systematically removed burdensome requirements and ended the practice of withholding these rights simply because of outstanding court costs. In June of 2015, I was proud that I had restored more voting and civil rights than any governor in the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia. But for me, that was not enough. So on April 22nd, 2016, I stood on the steps of the Virginia State Capitol, which was designed in 1785 by Thomas Jefferson, and I issued an executive order to restore the rights of all Virginians who'd served their time and had completed any supervision. That day, more than 200,000 Virginians earned back their right to vote. It was my proudest day as governor. We must ensure the rights of every citizen, which must also include those among us who have made mistakes, serve their time, return to our communities to make the most of their second chance. Unfortunately, when they do get out, their criminal record follows them as they look for work and housing, which are the basic necessities to help you have a second chance. And in Virginia, it's a mistake that stays with them even when they try to partake in democracy by voting. And there's a reason why, folks. 115 years ago, a felon disenfranchisement, a poll tax, and a literacy test were written into Virginia's Constitution. It is ironic that in this great country, with our imperfect history, we would punish those who've made a bad decision for the rest of their lives. Where would we be as a country if we were only judged by our mistakes? Why then do we judge and perpetually punish our fellow citizens who maybe got lost along the way? I've always said, you show me someone who's never made a mistake, and I'll show you a liar. These are the questions that I've asked myself as I've traveled around Virginia and heard story after story from people who'd been denied their basic rights for years, and some of them have never been able to vote in a single election. There was a reason why this happened. That 115 years ago, a state senator by the name of Glass put these into our Constitution. Stood exactly where I stood 115 years ago, and to quote him precisely, we are doing this, quote, to eliminate the darkie from being a political force in Virginia. Think about that for a second, folks. So on that April day, I was proud to restore the rights to folks like Terry Garrett, who'd been stripped of her rights after years of substance abuse and frequent incarcerations. Terry made mistakes. She served her time. She turned her life around. In addition to being a loving mother and grandmother, is now a respected community leader and a sponsor to recovering addicts and former offenders. Yet, as you know, Terry had remained a second-class citizen. Before that day in April of last year, this mother and grandmother did not have the right to vote, even though she had turned her life around and used her second chance to help others in need, especially those facing addiction. It was a sad legacy for the Commonwealth of Virginia. This policy was among the many Jim Crow-era voter intimidation tactics that have been used to block people of color from voting ever again. As governor, I could not accept this grave injustice. But like so many other paths to justice, ours was not without obstacles. Virginia's Republican legislature sued me the day I took that action, arguing that I did not have the authority to do a blanket restoration. On July 22nd, the Virginia Supreme Court ruled against us, not based on constitutional grounds, but because they, quote, no governor had ever done this before. Now, I'll be very frank with you folks. I went to Georgetown Law School. I went full-time day. While I was there, I ran three companies. I wasn't in the building much. But even with my limited legal knowledge, I knew I had the authority to do this. I think the statute of limitations is passed on how much time you're supposed to spend in law school. So think about this. Terry Gatner writes back, overjoyed, and here the Virginia Supreme Court had ruled against us, and she lost her right to vote again. I talked to her on that day. She was devastated. She couldn't talk. However, we weren't done fighting. On August 22nd, 2016, I stood in front of Virginia's historic Civil Rights Monument and initiated the new process of restoring rights. They had told me, if the governor's going to do it, he has to sign every single one individually. I said, line them up. I'll sign everyone individually if that's what it takes. So guess what happened? They didn't like that. Once again, I was sued. This time, the General Assembly Republican sued me for contempt of court. I now have the honor of being the first Virginia governor to be sued for contempt of court. This time, the Virginia Supreme Court sided in my favor and said he's doing it right by doing it individually, and Terry Garrett got her rights back again that day. And in November of last year, for the first time in her life, she walked into a voting booth to cast her ballot. With that vote, she officially regained her place in our society and showed us how powerful a second chance can be. Terry fulfilled this hard-fought civic duty with pride, something that nearly 100 million eligible Americans did not exercise last November. Earlier this year, I invited Terry to join me for my annual State of the Commonwealth address to the Virginia General Assembly in our historic capital. Terry stood in the balcony with tears streaming down her face as I honored her in a room with the very same people who had thought she was a second-class citizen and actually sued me to keep it that way. Over the past years, I've met countless people whose rights I've restored just like hers. These are our family, they're our friends, they are our neighbors. They send their children and grandchildren to our schools. They attend our churches, and they pay taxes. And now they can once again have a say in how their communities will grow. This is not just a Virginia problem. Nearly 6 million Americans with felonies around the country today cannot vote. Think about that. 6 million Americans. These are people just like Terry, who've served their time and are ready for a second chance, only to be shut out from their community, the community that they contribute to. When people return to their communities after being incarcerated, we want them and we need them to make the most of their second chance. Progress is rarely easy, and I knew this would be the start of a hard-fought battle, but clearly one worth fighting. As I look back on the past year and a half, I'm proud of the remarkable accomplishments that we've achieved because we never gave up on that fight. We stood up to take action that will become a hallmark of significance in the history of civil rights. And today, because of this work, I'm proud to stand here and say that we've restored the rights of more than 161,000 Virginians who had deserved a second chance. I now have the honor of restoring more rights than any governor in the history of the United States of America. Our work must continue until every person is ensured their basic human and basic civil rights. No voter should ever be barred from fulfilling their civic duty. No person should ever fall through the cracks of a broken criminal justice system. No child should be subjected to failing schools simply because of their family's economic status. Our efforts to date have started a long overdue conversation about how we view justice and how we can live up to our own American ideals. But we cannot continue that conversation without acknowledging how we got here in the first place. So yes, let's tear down those monuments and put them in the museums, in the battlefields, in the cemeteries where they truly belong. But let us also tear down the insidious policies that keep inequality and racism alive in our institution and in our attitudes. The greatest monuments that we can build to our nation's core values are not made of stone. We must actually live the American legacy that we all seek to honor by ensuring that every single child in this country has an equal shot to succeed, that every single man and woman who's made a mistake has a second chance to make it right, and that every American has a place to call home. That's what we've worked hard to do in Virginia under my watch. The progress that we've seen is just the start of a transformation that could take generations to be fully realized. That's why I hope this important work continues in January under my successor, because this isn't a Democrat or a Republican idea. It's an issue that cuts across economic status, race, origin, age, and political party. Incarceration and disenfranchisement have torn apart far too many families for far too long. And they've been used as legal tools to suppress the political and economic rise of our African-American friends and neighbors. Folks, it's past time for criminal justice reform. It is time for a criminal justice revolution. Thank you very much.
So I want to thank the governor for his thoughtful presentation. We appreciate him taking time out of his busy schedule. He had to leave because he's running to his next event, so was unable to stay longer. But we do have a distinguished panel of experts to continue the conversation. The moderator for our event is DeRay McKesson. He is a political activist and organizer for Campaign Zero, which seeks to end police violence. Joining him on the panel will be Sean Hopwood, who's an associate professor of law at Georgetown Law Center. He is the author of Lawman, My Story of Robbing Banks, Winning Supreme Court Cases, and Finding Redemption. And as far as I know, I believe he is the first bank robber to actually speak at the Brookings Institution. Also on the panel is Brittany Packnett. She is the Vice President for National Community Alliances at Teach for America. She also is a co-founder of Campaign Zero. Clint Smith is a doctoral candidate of education at Harvard University and also the author of Counting Dissent. He has given TED Talks on the danger of silence and how to raise a black son in America. So I will turn things over to DeRay to start the conversation.
Thank you, and thank you everybody for coming. Excited to be here. I'm excited to moderate this incredible panel. So I know these two, and I just met Sean today. When I think about Brittany, Brittany was appointed to the Ferguson Commission in Ferguson, and she was one of the original protesters out there in the beginning. It was also appointed by President Obama to the Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Clint, an incredible poet and academic who researches and studies the history of the civil rights movement and this work and has also done work in prisons. And Sean, a scholar and a former bank robber, who has written about how we change the system with everything from sentencing to the Speedy Trial Act. So excited to have this conversation. The first question that I pose is a reflection on the governor's speech. We have just as a country come off the heels of the initial incidents in Charlottesville, and there's been a lot of conversation about that. I'd be interested to know what your take is, especially as we talk about the climate of race and criminal justice reform. And we can start with you, Brittany.
Well, thanks so much for that question, and thanks to Brookings for hosting this important conversation and having us. I've got two kind of main reflections on the speech. One is that I appreciate the recognition of Charlottesville as an important moment, but we have to recognize that it's a moment in a long series of moments that is part of a system here, right? And that what we saw were some of the most vile evidence of white supremacy, racism, kind of the indoctrination of hatred in this country. And yet we see that act out every single day in our criminal justice system, in schools, on the street, in acts of protest, or the things that we're protesting against. And so I think it's really important that we frame this conversation properly in a broader system of white supremacy that does actually impact all of us every single day, because it is systemic, it is institutionalized, and it is woven into the very fabric of this country from policing on down. The other thing that the governor mentioned that I think is really important for this conversation is about how much this starts in schools. And we often discuss the school-to-prison pipeline, and it is that phrase has become very well known, thankfully. But the insidious ways in which this acts out for young people every day, I think we don't talk about enough. Because it's not just about how quickly you can enter the system as a child. It's also about the ways in which you internalize the idea that regular, normal childhood behaviors are indeed criminal. And they're especially criminal if you have brown skin. They're especially criminal if you are indigenous to this country. So we see African American and Native American children far surpassing all other children in juvenile detention, and they're outpacing their representation in this country. As the governor mentioned, black students being pushed into school suspension and other disciplinary measures at alarming rates. But it's also important to recognize that the kind of training that not just police officers, but teachers and principals and other folks are receiving doesn't actually cover a lot of this stuff. And so I hope that's something we can talk about today.
Thank you, Brittany. Go ahead.
Similarly, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And I was heartened by a lot of what the governor had to say. I was thinking a lot about the social science and how often, you know, for me as someone who's thinking about this and reading the social science and the empirics of it, often you often see a disconnect between what is politically expedient or politically palatable and what is actually proven to be effective through empirical evidence. And one of the things that the governor mentioned that I don't want to slip under the radar is that they've improved or made easier and facilitated and streamlined processes by which the families of young people who are incarcerated can visit them, because if you go through the social science, that is one of the most important things that can be done in order to reduce recidivism, is making sure that family ties, both in a juvenile context and an adult context, are maintained, because once people lose a sense of the community they have on the outside, they become a lot more disillusioned, and it becomes a lot more difficult to reintegrate yourself into the community once you're released. And we know that while I work predominantly with men and women who are serving life sentences, and that's what I'm thinking about in my own research and my dissertation, 95% of people who end up in prison or jail are eventually released, right? And so it's important for us to be thinking about not simply how this operates on the front end, but also recognizing that so much of this work has to be done on the back end, and I'm heartened that the governor talked about the initiatives that the state is taking with regard to driver's license, which is, you know, an example and a sort of microcosm of a series of, like, really silly, a policy that potentially seems really silly, but was clearly implemented with an intention of making it more difficult for people to navigate their lives effectively once they got out. And you know, it does make any sense that you wouldn't have access to a car to get to the job that you need in order to provide for yourself to make sure that you don't end up recidivating once again. And another thing that I thought was really important, so I taught high school English for several years before I started graduate school, and so I taught, you know, 15 and 16-year-olds, and now I work with men who are serving life sentences, and so I kind of see both the front and back end of how these systems operate. And what happens when you spend time in prison, as anyone who has stepped foot in a prison or has worked with those who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated will tell you, is that spending time in a prison completely disabuses you of any preconceived notions you had of, like, one, what a prison is, and then who the people in that prison are. I think, you know, as Sean will talk about, you know, we have so many caricatures of who we believe people in prison to be, and implicitly or explicitly, we often do not recognize the ways in which the arbitrary nature of circumstance, the conditions in which a person is born, inevitably shape the trajectory that that person ends up on. So, you know, for me, being inside of a prison was a daily reminder that but for the arbitrary nature of the zip code I was born into, the family I was born into, the schools I got the opportunity to attend, it could have very easily been me on the other side of the bar instead of someone who got to come in and out leaving on the same afternoon. And so I think that that's really important, and it's important for any of us who are concerned with these issues to recognize that this is not simply, we are not doing necessarily, like, favors to anyone. It is simply that we have to recognize that we, most of us in this room, have been put in positions where the trajectory of our lives put us on a very different path than the sort of, like, social, economic, and political landscape of the lives of those who often end up in prison are typically put on.
Thank you, Glenn. Sean?
Well, again, thanks for having me, and I hope the Brookings Institute starts inviting more felons into its midst. And the reason is, we're not any different than you. That's the big idea, and I was encouraged by two things that the governor said. One, that criminal justice reform is vital. The system is an absolute mess. You cannot believe that America is the land of liberty and the home of the free on the one hand, and then on the other realize that we incarcerate more of our citizens than almost any other country on the planet. It's counterproductive as well. It's a system where we send people to prison as a first response rather than a last resort, and a system that when we send people to prison, the longer they serve, the less likely they are to get out and not commit new crimes, doesn't really benefit anyone, including taxpayers and crime victims. And that's the big irony. Our prisons are so awful that people have a hard time recovering from prison. Everyone makes change. I was 21 when I committed my crimes, and I've made pretty profound change now at the age of 42. If we know people can change, why do we think prisoners can't? And if the answer is because they're serving time in prison, that says more about our system than it does them as individuals. And so there is lots of room for improvement, from sentencing to prison reform to, you know, it's not real easy for prisoners to be incarcerated for a decade and then released with very little job training. We expect a miracle to happen. You know, when I got out of prison in 2008, 2009, I had never been on the internet, never seen an iPad, never seen an iPhone. One of the places I applied to, Cockle Legal Briefs, which was my big, you know, they gave me a job. One of the problems I had with them was I had a reference letter from a really wonderful attorney, one of the best attorneys in the United States. And I thought this reference letter could help me get a job, and they said, please send us a PDF. Didn't know what a PDF was, and you know what? No one else in the halfway house did either. That one little hiccup that we all get past every single day and don't think about can be life-changing for people getting out of prison. And the recidivism rates in some places are as great as the five-year recidivism rate is 75%. So 3 out of 4 people coming out of prison are going to go back within 5 years. That system doesn't benefit any of us. So there is definitely the need for reform, but the thing I was encouraged most by what the governor said is that this is not just simply good government and what system do we want because it's the most beneficial to the most of us. It's also about justice. It's justice to give people second chances. It's justice that once they serve their time, we don't continue to punish that person for the rest of their lives. Because if you follow the legal system long enough, there are over 5,000 federal criminal rules and statutes that contain criminal penalties. There are thousands more in the states. Chances are all of you have committed a federal felony at some point in your life and you have no idea. And so to think that we will judge a person for the rest of their life based on a bad day, a bad week, or a bad year, as a matter of justice, that's simply wrong. We want to help people when they get out become productive citizens. But in order to do that, we've got to make some serious changes. But I was glad to hear that the governor thinks that this idea of second chances is not just good government, but it's actually justice.
Thank you, Sean. So I think about three things. You know, I've been on a lot of panels about criminal justice. This is the only panel I've been on where everybody's been a teacher at some point. So you taught elementary school, high school, and now you teach at the college level. I taught sixth grade math. I'm interested in having a conversation that we about some things that we don't normally talk about in the criminal justice space. When I reflect on the governor's speech, I think about what is a felon is one of the, he and I talked before, and it is fascinating that in cities across the country or in states, like the bar for what it means to be a felon is actually pretty low. In Chicago, it's $300, or in Illinois, it's $300, in Virginia, it's $200. That is so fascinating. I just was at the Cook County Jail, which is the largest single-site jail in the country. I also was at Angola, which is the largest landmass prison in the country. It's 28 square miles, 18,000 acres. Used to be 4 plantations put together, which is a wild thing. And I agree with you, Clint, that when you see a prison or jail, it like completely changes the way that you think about it. Clint, we'll start with you. I'd love to know how you think about how we got here, and then Sean, we'll go to you about the what are the parts about the criminal justice reform space, and then we'll go to you, Brittany, that we don't talk about enough or that we should be changing the conversation about in public? I think about the people that are here probably already agree that, like, we should do something. They've already heard sort of in the news at least, like, you know, we should decarcerate or, like, bail reform or, like, hot topics today. But how do we round those out in the public conversation? So, Clint, we'll start with you about how we got here, And then we'll pivot to Sean and Brittany.
Yeah, so as the governor alluded to, there's clearly a long history that stems from slavery, the Civil War, the failure of Reconstruction, or the purposeful and proactive killing of Reconstruction, and the onslaught of Jim Crow that play a huge role in shaping what our contemporary criminal justice system looks like. And I think that's important to name because that's something that we all sort of intuitively understand and carry with us. But part of what I think we don't do, oftentimes, you know, I mentioned the sort of dissonance in the conversation about in criminal justice around what is politically palatable and what actually is like really going to make a huge difference. And one of those things that we often talk about, the sort of standard discourse around incarceration centers on this idea of nonviolent drug offenders, right? And sort of the discourse that, you know, President Obama would talk about, that the governor has talked about, and that a lot of progressive politicians who are thinking about this issue often espouse is, you know, we have all these nonviolent drug offenders who are locked up for, selling marijuana on the street corner or doing drugs that, like, didn't represent a threat to anybody. And that is true. But the way we talk about it suggests that if we simply take away all the nonviolent drug offenders out of prison, that mass incarceration will suddenly go away. And that's simply not the case, right? What we know is that only 16% of people in state prisons are convicted of nonviolent drug offenses. We can have a different conversation about the sort of very blurry line between what constitutes as a violent versus a nonviolent crime. I think we think that demarcation is something that's very clear when it's really not. I think you think of, you know, a lot of the men that I work with who are serving life sentences are in there for violent offenses when they didn't do anything that is ostensible, that we would think of as ostensibly violent, whether it be the owning of a, or when they were arrested, they had an illegal gun or a gun that they hadn't purchased legally. And so in many states, that in and of itself constitutes as a violent crime, regardless of if you're using the gun or not. And so part of the difficult conversation that we have to have is what beyond nonviolent drug offenses led us to this moment. And, you know, we talk about the war on drugs a lot, but we don't talk about prosecutors enough. And I think we're starting to talk about prosecutors more and more often, but, you know, the sort of mythology of the criminal justice system that you see on Law and Order and all the TV shows, that everybody goes to court and there's a jury and there's, you know, it's a very dramatic thing, but that's not how most of these things happen. And 90% of criminal cases end in plea bargains. That means most of the discretion lies with prosecutors, right? So after mandatory minimums were imposed, you had this discretion that was taken away from judges, and that discretion was moved to prosecutors. And ostensibly and theoretically, that would be a good thing because, you know, prosecutors are democratically elected, and thus one intuitively believes that there's more transparency, and if they're doing something wrong, that somebody can sort of, just not elect them the next time. But the reality of the role of the prosecutor means that the same level of transparency doesn't exist in a prosecutorial capacity as would exist in a different elected capacity. So we don't know a lot about what prosecutors are doing in the same way that we often know what other city council members are doing and different things like that, because of the nature of the position, so many of those things are in the dark. And so part of what we have to do is recognize that prosecutors have a wide range of discretionary power that is often used to put people away for much longer than they need to be. An important statistic to think about is that by 2030, a third of our prisoners will be over the age of 55 years old, right? And so when we talk about the sort of relationship between the economics of this issue and the sort of morality of this issue, it's not simply that we are putting people in prison long after all social science demonstrates that they will not, they are less and less likely to commit a crime, right? Because all of the data suggests that after a certain age, around 35, the likelihood of you committing crimes like goes down in like a really dramatic manner. But when we're not addressing that, you have all the healthcare costs that are going to be associated with this increasingly aging population. You have all of the cost of staffing and building more prisons. And so all of that's to say, the reason we got here is not, I think what I want people to take away is not simply because of nonviolent drug offenses, it's not simply because of Nixon or Reagan's war on drugs, but it's because we moved from a system that in which the discretion stood mostly or existed mostly in the hands of judges and juries and moved almost singularly to prosecutors in a way that often exists in the dark that we can't see.
Thank you, Clint. Sean?
Yeah, so there are six big areas that need reform. And it starts from the front end to the back end. So the first would be policing. We have lots of issues with policing. That has kind of come to the forefront in the last couple of years with Ferguson and Baltimore and Chicago and all of these other cities. So we've got to re-examine that. We've got to re-examine what Clint just said, which is we have way too many laws, criminal laws in this country. It used to be that criminal law represented something that all of society can agree is wrong. But when you have 7,000-8,000 things that are considered wrong and criminalized, what it does when you make everything illegal, you give all of this power to the prosecutor. And what happens is when legislatures, state legislators or Congress pass these laws, they write them very broadly. And it basically gives what they write is the law is not actually the law, because the law is whatever the assistant U.S. attorney or the state prosecutor says it is. There are so many laws that we don't enforce. So there's another area. Then you have the criminal process area, which I would say the biggest need there is representation of indigent defendants. We have all of these wonderful procedural protections in the Bill of Rights, like Miranda and illegal searches and seizures and a right to a jury trial. But if you don't have a lawyer, and you don't have a lawyer that's a good lawyer, that can weaponize those rights and apply those against the criminal justice system, none of those really matter. When you have a public defender who has 300 cases per year, no one could do a good job doing that. And so indigent representation is probably our biggest issue there. And you move to the next, which is sentencing reform. On the whole, the United States incarcerates people for far greater and far longer than most countries, and that is definitely an issue. I often, when I talk about prison reform, the first thing I tell people is, you want to reform prisons and outcomes of people coming out of prison, don't give them a long sentence to begin with. It's very difficult for a prisoner to get up every day and kind of seize the day and become improve themselves for release when you're facing a 20-year sentence. It's even harder if you're 20 years old at the same time. I remember when I was looking at the face of basically going to be incarcerated for 11 years, I thought, oh, when I get out, I'm going to be in my 30s. I'm going to be so old. But that's how a 20-year-old thinks. And so it's very hard to get people in the mindset of rehabilitation and preparing for release when the light at the end of the tunnel is so far off. We also obviously have to reform our prisons. There are a few prison systems in the world that are worse than ours. Violence. I saw more drugs in federal prison than I ever saw out. There were 8 guards that were indicted at the federal prison I was at. I saw things that don't make any sense as a rational matter. We had a really great welding program for prisoners when I got there. People were getting out and being hired for that, making $20 to $25 an hour, which for someone coming out of prison, that's like the gold standard. New warden came in and decided, well, I can get more money if I change the program. So he changed the program and took the welding program out and started a business management associate degree. Because everyone knows that people want to hire felons to manage their businesses when they get out. And so we need to reform prison. And then the last piece is the reentry. There was nothing that the prison I was at prepared me for reentry, despite the fact that I had done almost 11 years. Simple things like getting a driver's license. Why aren't we explaining to people coming out of prison how to do that? When I got to the halfway house, I was told I can't leave until I get a job, and I can't get a job till I get a bank account. And when I went to get a bank account, the credit agencies had listed me as deceased. And so it took me weeks, and I had to hire lawyers because the halfway house wouldn't help me to get that fixed so that I could get a bank account, so that I could get a job, so that I could get on with my life. And we don't think about these little hurdles, but there are all sorts of small hurdles out there that can trip people up. And, you know, if you see a door closed every time you open it, eventually people revert back to what they did before. And that's why our recidivism rate is so high. Every successful reentry story I have ever seen, almost all of them involve community. People coming out of prison and embraced, whether it's at a church or a nonprofit, something. Because when you have community around you, you don't want to commit new crimes because you don't want to let those people down. But our current system takes people out of community, puts them into isolation, and makes it so that it's very hard for them to continue ties with the outside world while they're incarcerated. That's why the move to put juveniles closer to their parents is so important. It's the same for adults that have kids. Why don't we want the adults to be able to see their kids more often while they're incarcerated? We just don't do a very good job of preparing any of these things, and that's why our outcomes are so bad. As you can see, it's pretty daunting because we need reform basically from start to finish.
Thank you, Sean.
I think what was so important about Sean's point is that it's the recognition that there are multiple systems complicit in this outcome, right? It's not just about prisons. It's not just about police. It's not just about prosecutors and defenders. It's about all of this. And to make it more daunting, I would add one to your list, which brings me back to my original point, because we have to not just think about the school-to-prison pipeline, but really the cradle-to-prison pipeline. And in my view, I kind of see four steps, right? So there are a lot of children who are essentially born into this culture, right? Now, there are children who are literally born into this. There are 12,000 pregnant women imprisoned every single year in this country. And there are 28 states that have no laws disallowing what's called shackling during birth. So the mothers are actually shackled while they're giving birth, which not only for any of the women who have given birth in here, if you can imagine not being able to move your body to be more comfortable during the most painful experience of your life. So it's difficult for the mother, but it's also very difficult for the child because it makes it much harder for the doctors to deliver a healthy baby. So you've got children who are literally born into this, but also this broader culture that Clint has already walked us through, that are born into communities that have been completely destroyed by mass incarceration, the war on drugs, et cetera. And so you're born into this idea that you start to internalize that the people who look like you, the people in your zip code, the people in your neighborhood, are somehow inherently more criminal than the folks you might see on TV, the folks across town, et cetera, right? So first you're born into this culture. Then you're disciplined into it once you get into school. I remember we were training our teachers in St. Louis, and I went to one of the schools where someone else was in charge, but one of my staff members was there to observe a teacher, and she called me and said, "I need you to come down here immediately." And I came down to find a 7-year-old handcuffed to a chair. I don't know what a 7-year-old could possibly have done that bad that he could be handcuffed to a chair, and the story that I was told certainly did not meet the bar for that kind of restriction. But we have to recognize that the culture of education in this country is one of compliance and not of empowerment, right? So if it's all about controlling your body and controlling the way that you move, controlling how much you move, then, yeah, it would actually unfortunately make sense that a 7-year-old is handcuffed to a chair if people feel like they can't control him, right? Instead of having a conversation, instead of asking what's wrong, that's the solution. I talked to a friend of mine yesterday whose sister pulled her son out of a school 3 days into the school year because she said the kids wear orange uniforms and her son kept coming home saying, I can't sit the way that they want me to sit for 45 minutes, mommy. And so again, this idea that compliance and restriction is better than empowerment is what we as adults come into the education space thinking is right, and yet it is deeply problematic for children. So imagine coming from a culture that says somehow the way that people like me behave is criminal, and then I come into an institution that tells me the same thing, that gives me the same message. I'm continuously internalizing this idea. Then we are, the governor talked about a criminal justice revolution. Well, our young people are discouraged from revolution from the very beginning. So here's what's really interesting, and Amanda Ripley has done some really important reporting on this. There are 22 states that have laws against what's called disturbance in schools, right? So this is what I mean when I talk about criminalizing everyday childhood behaviors. As you said, all of us were teachers. We've all been disturbed. we were all disturbances at some point when we were students. But because I was at a multiple intelligences private school, my disturbances were seen as creative or something to talk to my mother about during parent-teacher conferences. It wasn't seen as criminal, right? For so many of our young people, it's seen as criminal. And a lot of these videos that we've seen gone viral, the thing that happens in schools where we see, officers throwing kids and kids getting shackled and stuff like that. The thing that happens behind the scene is that often the young person who put out the video is actually admonished for disturbance. And in 22 states, that's a criminal offense, right? So kids are everything from expelled to actually seeing criminal charges brought against them simply for telling the truth. And if you're discouraged from telling the truth as early as elementary school, then you can bet that that criminal justice revolution that we need is not going to come. So you're born into it, you're disciplined into it, you're discouraged from revolutionizing it. And then lastly, at the federal level, especially now, we're not seeing any protections for it. So I get deeply worried when I see what's happening at this Department of Education around the Office of Civil Rights, how many complaints have been dismissed outright just in the last few weeks. If there's no place to take these things, if there's no one who's actually going to do something about this, then we end up in the exact same system, Sean, that you just described. And so I would add that seventh piece on the very front end, because we've created a culture for too many of our young people that give them the idea that this is normal and that this is the way that things have to be. You know, the governor talked about the danger of convention and how we can get just caught up in a cycle because we've always done it this way. And for so long, we've always done education this way. And it is extremely dangerous to students, and we're not going to get that revolution that we need until we start protecting them and actually empowering them.
And I actually saw some of that in prison. When I got to the federal prison, there was a row of cells. I tell this story a lot because it's just emblematic of the system as a whole. There was a row of cells, African-American men. They called themselves neighbors. Neighbors because they were in cells right next to each other, but also neighbors because the feds had come into their neighborhood in Milwaukee and basically got them all on this huge crack conspiracy and gave them 20-year sentences. And there were about 10 of those guys. And when I got to the prison, they were about halfway through their sentence. And when I was getting ready to come home, so were they. And you would have thought it would have been a great day of joy for them. The problem was the last few years, their sons started coming into prison. Because you take all the dads out of a neighborhood and, you know, what do you expect to happen? And so there's this always this cycle of people coming in and out of prison. And we've got to do something to break it because it just devastates families, devastates communities.
And the reality is that, to build on Sean's point, is that Milwaukee is the most segregated city in the, in the United States, right? So you cannot disentangle the realities of housing segregation and housing discrimination and the decades and decades of public policy and social engineering that made it so that certain communities were prioritized and other communities were deprioritized with regard to access and resources and opportunities and the sort of social bedrocks upon which intergenerational wealth and health are founded upon, from the trajectory that puts someone on a trajectory to end up in prison, right? So it's important that we're thinking about this on the front end, in the while people are in prison, and on the back end. And too often, you know, in education, this often happens. We talk about these issues in silos, and people will look at a school and they'll say, "Oh, well, the teachers are not doing this, or the students are not doing this." And in prison, we fall into the same trap. Oftentimes, we look at, we say this is what's happening at this prison, and then this is the recidivism rate, right? But we're not talking about how prison fits into the sort of larger ecosystem of things that are happening before someone even ends up in prison. Right. And it's essential that we're having this conversation, these conversations alongside one another rather than separately.
Yeah, so I'll recap some of the things that really resonated, and then we'll set up for the how do we get out of this mess. So we talk about what the problem is, and it's so bad, and it's like, what do we actually do? Clint, one of the things that I'm mindful of that you said is this idea that it's not just the nonviolent drug offenders, right? That like people, so much of the conversation is about the nonviolent population, but we could free all of them and we'd still have a really big problem in a way that people just don't talk about. And this question of like, what is violent? You know, I was in Chicago and it's like, if you are like accomplices are considered violent in almost every state. So you just being around the crime is like coded as a violent offense in places. And there is this question, if you ask the public, like, what is a felon, that like people's go-to is like kill 35 people and like blew up a supermarket and a building, right? Like it's the most heinous version of whatever crime looks like. But like stealing an iPhone is a crime in places like Virginia, in places like Chicago, right? So like, how do we help people think about these fundamental sort of issues differently? Sean, when I think about you, it struck me how in the media and in public, we've like normalized long sentences. Like a 10-year sentence on Law and Order is just like a simple, you're like 10 years, right? Or like 20 years, of course I got 20 years. And you're like, that's a long time, but that is a long time. Especially when you think about like the lack of programming or anything substantive that's happening during those years. So I'm struck by that. The second about, you know, people we don't talk about in public, how not every place has a public defender, because on TV, everybody gets a public defender. But there are cities across the country, there are states like that don't have public defenders, that don't have public defender systems at all. And like, we just don't talk about that. So like, it's like these random private attorneys sort of giving people advice, but not in a coordinated way, in a way that makes sense to people. And like, that is sort of wild. And the third will be this focus on literacy. And it, you made me think about it, Sean, and Brittany, you made me think about it. When we think about like, what are we doing on the front end with our kids? And then what are we not doing once people actually get into jail? And you think about cities like Baltimore, where there was a stat where like, I'm from Baltimore, where 30% of adults cannot functionally read. And it's like, what does it mean to create opportunity for people when like, they can't read, right? And like, you literally have a captive audience, like no pun intended. It's like they are not going anywhere. You could run like the most streamlined literacy program for every juvenile offender, for every adult offender, like you could do it. But the people that staff most of our prisons and jails are like social work. They're like, they are not educators normally. They are like mental health professionals, and that's really important. So how do we like actually have a real robust conversation about like literacy work or like the core skill development when we think about prisons and jails? And just for like a teaching moment, jails are before you've been convicted of anything, and prisons are after you've been convicted of things, if you didn't know. So let's start with you, Sean, and we'll work our way down about like, how do we get out of this? Like, what is the, so either like, what are the biggest levers? Like, where should the energy be now? Like, where should we focus on now, knowing there are more than one thing to do? And how would you, if people ask you like, what can I do? Sort of what's your response to them?
I think about that question a lot because, you know, time is infinite, and I want to do work where I feel like I can make an impact. And I can't tell you, as I feel like I always make an impact every time I go to Capitol Hill. Like, I come back from Capitol Hill usually thinking, was this worth my time? I think the first thing we need to do is we have...
I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, yeah. We have had a lot more talk and discussions about criminal justice reform in the last 5 years than we have, you know, since I've been alive. But we also, I think one thing we forget is that we have not convinced everybody. And there are people that think, my family was included until I got locked up, that the people that go to prison are the evil ones, the really bad ones. And then you get to prison, and my family would come visit me, and they would realize on visit, oh, these are just normal people. Who for whatever reason made bad mistakes. So I don't think we have convinced people yet, most people in America, that we need change. And I think that's one area that we need to do. And we need to get more people that have been to prison out and become leaders in that and out in the community. I often tell people I committed a violent crime, but I'm not a violent person. Turns out most of the social science, which you've talked a lot about, that's the big area for reform to me. We know so much more about how humans behave, and behavioral science has made huge gains. But you don't see any of that filter into our criminal justice practices. You know, we know that people will age out of crime in their 30s and 40s. Yet, we tend to lock up people for 20, 30 years at a pop, even when they aren't actually a danger, no longer a danger to society. And so I think we need to educate average Americans about what the criminal justice system is like. And, you know, as far as places to do that, there are lots of nonprofits and advocacy groups. I'm involved with Families Against Mandatory Minimums. I've also done work with everyone from the ACLU National Prison Project on litigation to Prison Fellowship, which is the largest prison ministry in the world. And so there are lots of places to fit in, but we've got to convince Americans first of the problem. And then we need, what we need is one state to jump in and say, we're going to redo everything. We're not going to lock up. Yeah, we're not going to lock up everyone. We're going to use prison as a last resort, and we're going to change how we treat prisoners. And I think if we have one state that does that and has success, that will be the big difference maker. But we got to get one jurisdiction to make pretty huge changes, because right now we're just making progress at the margins, and with a population of 2.2 million people, we need big changes. We need big changes. And so we've got to convince one jurisdiction to make the change. And I think if one does, the outcomes will be so much better that other states will be forced to. If for nothing else, they'll see the money. the money that we expend and that it could be spent better places than locking people up for decades.
Before we go to you, Clint, we will be taking questions from the crowd, so think about your questions because we'd love for you to push them as well. And I'm reminded, too, that, you know, sometimes locking people up is like an easy solution for policymakers in the absence of thinking about anything else creatively or, like, how do we actually deal with this on the front end? Like, this becomes an easy solution even though it doesn't lead to a decrease in crime.
I feel that way when I have my kids at home. Like, it's easy when they mess up to just go put them in a room and say, you're grounded or you're in trouble. Much more difficult to actually sit down with them and address the root problems of the misbehavior. That's exactly what we do with the criminal justice system. And it's exactly why it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about a couple things. So one, just really want to like harken back on part of what we have to do is like really push ourselves away from the idea that nonviolent drug offenders and releasing nonviolent drug offenders will like stop mass incarceration, right? The statistic we often hear, which is important because it's true, is that we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. If we released every nonviolent drug offender from every prison, there would still be 1.7 million people in our jails and prisons, right? And so that's still, we moved from a fourth of the world's prison population to a fifth of the world's prison population. And that's not to say that, you know, I want to be clear that those people should not be in prison, right? I'm not saying that we shouldn't focus on that, but oftentimes we are sort of like myopically focusing on that at the expense of a larger conversation. And the real conversation that has to happen, that is difficult to happen, and you know, I give the governor a lot of credit, but it's also important to know that he didn't name folks in the speech who were violent offenders, right? And that's because it's a lot more politically difficult to navigate that terrain because of the sort of connotations associated with the idea of how, as you mentioned, kind of like what people think of when they think of felons. They're like, oh, this is everybody is a murderer or a rapist and et cetera. And the difficult thing to do is like what we have to really consider, what does it mean? So maybe someone, you know, someone, for example, one of the men that I worked with, he robbed a bank or robbed a McDonald's when he was 17, shot the cashier. And now he is currently 62 years old. And so the question is, should this person who took someone's life when he was 17 years old, clearly that is not okay. Clearly there should be some sort of justice for that. The question is, should that person spend the rest of their life in prison with no opportunity to get out, which is the context that he finds himself in, right? Serving life without the possibility of parole. And these are difficult questions to grapple with, right? I remember that when I was first teaching in prisons, I didn't ask any questions about why the men I was working with were in there, because I was scared that if I found out why they were in there, then it would change the way that I thought about them. My second year when I was teaching in prison, I knew what everybody in the room had done. And it's not to say that it is, I'm spending time reading, Derek Walcott poems with men who are murderers, right? And when I was working with them, I didn't see murderers, right? It's kind of to Sean's point, like they're not singularly defined, as Bryan Stevenson always talks about. People cannot singularly be defined by the worst thing that they've ever done, especially when they did that thing as a child, right? And so should someone be punished throughout for the rest of their lives for something they did as a child? I think that's a really important thing to address. And one other point that I just want to make is that a lot of people in this room or watching online or on C-SPAN are business owners or work with organizations or know people who are business owners and work with organizations. And oftentimes, you know, people be like, well, what can I do? It's really important to account for the ways that like small, otherwise not malevolent decisions continue to shape and perpetuate the difficulties that formerly incarcerated folks have of getting jobs, right? So even if you're someone who is like the owner of a toy store and somebody comes into your comes in for an interview or turns in their application and you see that they were convicted of a felony, you have been trained and inundated with messages throughout your entire life to suggest that that is something you should swipe aside. And for you, it might simply be, that's just good business. I'm just protecting, you know, my business or my family or my coworkers. I think those are the moments where it's really important to say, to kind of step back and sort of check yourself and ask, is this decision that I'm making, am I making a holistic decision based on everything that I know about this person and what they offer, the possibilities they offer as a future employee of my business? Or am I making this decision in a way that is predicated upon this person being formally incarcerated and allowing my biases that are like deeply embedded within all of us, right, to shape the sort of business decisions that I'm making. I think that these are like small decisions that many people make that end up contributing to recidivism rates and that end up making it more difficult for formerly incarcerated folks to have jobs.
So three things. You know, I like numbers.
I like it.
You teach. You just learn how to package these things. The first is to properly treat. So as the resident woman on not just this, but a lot of criminal justice panels, it is really important to talk about women who are incarcerated because it often goes undiscussed. 71% of women who are incarcerated have experienced a traumatic event. What is a traumatic event? It means that they were either victims of or exposed to domestic violence. It means that they've suffered or suffered from substance abuse, or they and or they have experienced or suffer from some kind of mental illness that usually has been untreated or undertreated, right? So this is what I mean when I'm talking about all of these systems being complicit, right? Because now we can have a conversation about healthcare. But when we don't properly treat women, they end up in these circumstances. And what we also know to be true, and this isn't from some kind of spun study, this is directly from Department of Justice statistics, what we know is that white women are much more likely to receive treatment when they are discovered to have these things, and women of color are much more likely to be criminalized. Period, end of story. I mean, for us, that's kind of well, yeah, of course. But I think a lot of people are surprised by just the sheer volume of incarcerated women who this probably was preventable had things been treated correctly on the front end. And so I think that that's one of the really big things. The second is to properly train folks. You know, when I was on the President Obama's policing task force, I have to be clear about which president, President Obama's policing task force, we talked a lot about training, right? If we are going to live in a world where there are police, and I think we need to be having a broader conversation about whether or not policing as it is now is what we need to continue doing. But if we're going to live in a world with this system, then our folks have to be trained properly. But myself, Brian Stevenson was also on that task force, other folks, we made sure that when we were talking about training, we weren't just talking about beat cops and officers. We were also talking about teachers, administrators, school district officials, school resource officers, and quite frankly, parents who don't really understand what discipline looks like in a school and need to understand what is right and what should be happening for my child and what is actually improper, but I'm just so used to it that I don't question it. And if the kind of training that those folks are receiving is not culturally responsive and relevant, is not based in affirmation, but is instead based in deficits, which is what we're dealing with now, then we're going to continue to see these same problems, especially when we think about how much kids of color and girls of color in particular are adultified very early. So we start to see them as more responsible at ages as young as 5. And so suddenly the things that they do that are childlike for everyone else are somehow much more punishable for those kids. The last thing we have to do, and I want to bring it back to Sean's point, is to properly humanize folks. It was easy to lock people away in a room for 10, 20, 30 years, their entire life, if you don't really see them as human. And we've talked about this on the podcast before. That's the thing that I think we really have to grapple with, that your family didn't discover until they came to visit you, right? I have had family members that are incarcerated, and it puts a very different spin on things when you have to recognize, I still love you, I still see you as human, I still see you as valuable, irrespective of this thing that you did. And I also am fighting a lot of folks who don't see you that way. And if we don't start looking at folks who are in these circumstances as fully human and fully capable, then we're actually not going to get anywhere.
And just to piggyback quickly on that point, I think one of the things that contributes to humanization is proximity. And I think to the extent to which people can come and exist in proximity to those who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated, like, really does a lot to recalibrate the way that you understand these institutions and the people who are a part of these institutions. And there are a myriad of organizations, all you have to do is hop on Google, that do work around reentry here in D.C. and around the country, around reentry, around work with formerly incarcerated folks. But even, you know, a lot of these prisons and jails also have like are attempting to build, some more than others, robust volunteer programs. And you'd be surprised and really shocked how if you just simply send an email or show up to a prison and say, I am a yoga instructor, or I teach poetry, or I'm a cook and want to teach a culinary class, like, some, they are desperate to give So many wardens, especially wardens who are becoming more and more thoughtful about these issues, are desperate to provide any sort of programming that they can, especially free programming, to the people in their prisons. And so if you have some time and you're thinking about what can I do, how can I contribute, it makes even if you can only go once a year, it really makes a difference for you and then your ability to advocate on behalf of the incarcerated community if you are in proximity to those who we're often talking about.
In proximity in a respectful way,
right?
Where you're actually offering a service and not just being a cultural tourist,
right,
observing people in their worst moments.
John, you were going to say something?
Yeah, well, I go into a lot of prisons and I take a lot of people into prisons. And what they always say is, this has profoundly changed not the prisoners, but them when they've come into prison. And for prisoners, having volunteers come in kind of keeps you tethered to the real world and not prison, which is very important for rehabilitation purposes. The people that do best are the ones that are thinking about the day I'm coming home, not what's going on here today in the prison. And he's right, that you can all go volunteer at any prison. And I would tell you that once you do, you'll probably want to go back more and more, and you'll probably want to then invite other people. And that's what we really need. We need, like, armies of volunteers to go in. And if the government's not going to provide job training on how to get a driver's license, then we should. I think most of the solutions are going to come from not necessarily from government, but from businesses and just individuals who, you know, my wife sitting up here, she drove me around to, like, 30 job interviews. This was 2008. It was the height of the recession. No one was finding work. Well, I'm the guy that just got out of federal prison. And, you know, she was a resource to me that other people did not have. And you know, everybody thinks that I'm a pick-yourself-up-by-the-bootstrap story, but I'm the opposite of that. I had resources and people that poured grace into my life. And that's the difference between me and the person that went back to prison. Mm. I'd like to tell you it's different, but it's not. It's really that simple.
You know, one of the things that we don't talk about a lot, and you, Sean, Clint, you've talked about it, is like the power that wardens have is that you'd be shocked at, like, from prison to prison or jail to jail. Like, the people that run the prisons have, like, a lot of unchecked. It's not like a law. It wasn't like the governor's decree that said it. It was, like, literally, like, the warden. I was at one place, and, like, the warden was just really religious. So, like, he did all this stuff because he thought God said that he should do it. And you're like, that's interesting. And it worked out in the prisoner's favor in most cases because he was so religious. But, like, some things shouldn't just be at the discretion of, like, the random sort of warden who is there. So let's be able to take some questions. I think there's, like, a microphone or somebody has a microphone, they told me, right here. So we'll go to him.
My name's Elliot Hurwitz, and I want to thank the panel for a very good conversation. I have two questions. First, I'd like to ask if anyone saw the piece on 60 Minutes last night on the reforms in the Cook County prison in Illinois.
And, I was on a plane.
And second, I'd like to ask about the statement that was on the panel that Milwaukee is the most segregated community in the United States. I was married in Milwaukee in 1972. That was some time ago. But I'd like to see, like to hear if there's any more evidence on that point. Thank you very much.
There's a great book by sociologist Matthew Desmond that just won the Pulitzer, Evicted. That's sort of in part of that, part of his research outlines the ways in which community segregation and neighborhood segregation contributes to really high homelessness rates and eviction rates that disproportionately affect people of color and specifically disproportionately affect women of color. He often talks about how mass incarceration is this system that deeply impacts black men and eviction is this phenomenon that deeply impacts black women in a sort of similarly disproportionate way. The research is pretty clear. I think you've just, if you Google it, and it came to the fore after the police violence that was in Milwaukee, I think 2 years or so ago. And there were a lot of articles in the Times and different things about it. So, and, you know, part of the, this is not a panel on housing, but we could, it's essential to understand the ways in which the history of redlining and housing segregation and zoning policies, both in a historical and a contemporary sense, shape the dynamics of what different communities look like. And Milwaukee is sort of a case study in the way that A community has been constructed through systems of redlining, through systems of certain people being afforded loans to buy houses in certain communities, or certain real estate companies refusing to give to sell houses to immigrants or black people or brown people in certain communities. And those, inevitably, the more segregated a community, the more stratified and isolated resources become. And the more stratified and isolated resources become, the more desperate the circumstances of the people within those communities. And thus, you know, the ostensible rational decisions that people make to are in response to, like, deeply irrational and sort of insidious circumstances.
So we're going to go back here. I saw him back here. I'm going to the Cook County Jail actually tomorrow to meet with Sheriff Tom Dart, who's the sheriff of the Cook County Jail. I know that they did just have the 60-minute special. They're doing a lot of interesting things in Cook County. And in September, there's a judge's order that the chief judge down there, the judge's order will effectively end money bail in most situations, or it should, is people's hope. So that will be interesting. Cook County Jail has experienced a big decrease in the number of arrestees in Cook County. It went from like 18,000 to 10,000 now, mostly because of after Laquan McDonald got killed, the arrest rate in Chicago has dropped precipitously, which is good for it's good for the people not being arrested right now. So, but Cook County is a place to look at for a model in some ways. Did you see your hand back there? That was you, right? Yes. Oh, no, your hand wasn't up? Okay, cool. Sorry. Okay, we'll go to you right there. She's on this, yeah, right here. Yeah. In the back, all the way in the back.
Thank you. Thank you for this awesome event. I think that one of the things we have to look at is the mindset that prevails. We're guilty until we're proven innocent, not the other way around. And I share the frustration of going to Capitol Hill far too many times and coming back with nothing. And the specific case I want to talk about is Khalif Browder. And I don't know how you all think we can avoid having ever another Khalif Browder situation, but his only crime was he just happened to be a poor black teenager who couldn't raise bail. And in the end, he had done nothing wrong.
Yep.
So if you could speak to that for a minute, that would be appreciated.
Brittany?
I had literally just written down Khalif's name because I didn't want it to go unspoken in this space. I had the really unique opportunity to posthumously honor him. So if you are not familiar with Khalif Browder's story, Spike TV did a 3 or 4 part documentary on him, which is quite frankly required viewing if you are interested in this topic. But he was a young man who was falsely accused of stealing a backpack. Was jailed at Rikers Island for a very long time, awaiting trial, right? So not even having been convicted of anything, suffered an immense amount of abuses in Rikers Island, had a very difficult time with reentry, and ultimately took his life. And so we find Khalif Browder's story to be not just a particularly tragic example, but for me, he is like one of the greatest heroes of this movement, because without his willingness to tell his story when he was alive, this just would have gone undiscussed. So I want to thank you for bringing him up. There are some quick solutions, like closing places like Rikers, right, that are necessary, and recognizing the Rikers that are in every single state in this country, and closing those. But I think you speak to something much more insidious, which is why we spend a lot of time, those of us who work on policing, on racial bias issues, on properly disciplining police, on the ways in which police unions actually protect people from being disciplined and keep folks on the force that shouldn't be on the force, and allow for many Khalif Browders to exist around this country. It's got to be a multi-layer approach in that way that takes on policing, the actual criminal justice system, right? So defense and prosecutors, and that takes on the nature of jails, especially juvenile detention facilities. Because as you are still developing as a young person, as Khalif Browder was, the kind of feudal mentality that exists in a lot of juvenile detention centers for a means of survival, often against corrupt guards, which was true in his case, can like completely destroy the rest of your life. And so we find that his case was so tragic, but that unfortunately, like I said, there were lots of Khalif Browders in the country. But I believe the answer to your question is that we've got to come from every angle at that thing.
And I think what Khalif's story, just to mention quickly, also demonstrated is that there's far too low a bar. Maybe Sean can speak to this a little bit, but seems to me to be far too low a bar for people who are becoming correctional officers. There's a great piece that was in Mother Jones last year by Sean Bauer, in which he went undercover as a correctional officer, and he talks about how easy it was. I mean, he is like before he went undercover, he was like very well-known reporter. And he went undercover, and he talked about how easy it was for other people that he worked with who probably shouldn't have been in the positions of power and authority that they were, that's inherent to being in an incarcerated space, who simply slid under the radar, or the ways in which once they were in there was like very little accountability in terms of the way that they operated and the way that they bestowed their authority and enacted that upon the prison population. And so I think that that's also something to consider, is that there is an inherent power bestowed upon those who are correctional officers in prisons and jails throughout the country. And we don't often talk about what it takes or what it doesn't take necessarily to like get into that position, and if these people are qualified to be in positions where, you know, you look at the Spike TV documentary and you see the footage of how these officers were treating Khalif, and Khalif is like, again, just as we mentioned, as a microcosm of something that happens and does or doesn't get caught on camera all the time across this country. And I think that that's something we also need to be considering too, is who are we allowing to have into these prisons, and how much power and accountability is being afforded to those individuals.
And to be clear, just to put this together for folks who don't know his story well, the correctional officers in Rikers essentially started this thing called the program, which was the gang system in the jail, such that they could smuggle in the things that they wanted to, make the money. But it wasn't the kids that set this up. It was the correctional officers. And so who got jumped, when they got jumped, if kids didn't get with the program, here was your punishment. The correctional officers came up with that.
And the other thing is that we can end money bail. So D.C. doesn't have money bail. Kentucky, New Jersey. Like, people talk about bail reform, and it becomes like this theoretical thing that we can never do. And it's like, places have already done it. You know what I mean? Like, it is a real thing. It can happen. And like, we can close Rikers. You know, the interesting thing about Rikers is it's essentially the only jail in New York City, right? Which is why everybody goes there right now. And closing it, I was just with de Blasio not too long ago and the people leading the Close Rikers campaign. Closing it will essentially require the creation of a jail in every borough. And it's been interesting because one of the hard things about this work is that sometimes we find ourselves with unlikely foes, right? So you think about the correction officers, is that in a lot of cities, the correction officers are people of color, they're women, they're like low-wage workers, they're people who are like actually fighting against closing the prisons, because if they close a prison, then they're all of a sudden out of a job, right? Or they're people who want Rikers to close but don't want a jail anywhere near them. And it's like, well, we got to figure out like how do we actually make this work. I think there's time for one last question.
Thank you. I'm a 35-year veteran of the criminal justice system, criminal defense lawyer, 20 years of trial judge in Arizona, of all places, and not just Arizona, but Maricopa County, Sheriff Joe's County. Had the pleasure of riding on an elevator one day going to lunch, and he was in the back of the elevator. I got on, and he said, there's one of those liberal judges that just got on. And I said, well, if there are any more fascists on board, please push the lobby button for me. We'll go to lunch. Let's talk about it. The problem is so daunting, and the task set for reformers is so vast and difficult. Maybe a simpler solution would be to declare the system bankrupt, put it into a bankruptcy-type proceeding, Chapter 11, maybe reorganization, and charge our policymakers with the task of, on a slate, a clean board, whiteboard, blackboard, whatever, come up with a new system. What would it look like? Where would it start? Where would it end? And everything in between. But the problem is, in my view, the state lawmakers and most federal lawmakers are not going to make those changes and decisions. Follow the money. Until we take big money out of state and federal elections and publicly finance those elections, I think that will give you a different kind, not necessarily a better legislator, but a different kind of legislator, more interested in pursuing the public interest. D.C. has a chance to adopt fair election law, includes public funding, and I would hope that you contact your council person to express your, and the mayor's office. She's on the fence about this. And try it. It's a voluntary system. It has to be now. But give it a try, and you'd be surprised how different kinds of lawmakers you get into making policy. So bankruptcy may be a solution. Chapter 11 reorganization might be a model to take.
We'll get them to respond to that. Yeah. No, and I had the time messed up, so we can get your question too. Okay. Bankruptcy. Are we imagining big enough in terms of how we dismantle the system?
I mean, I was thinking about that, right? I mean, because the thing that we haven't actually said is, what is a world without jails, right? What does it look like that if you make a mistake that there is a different pathway toward the future? So, you know, I don't necessarily there were lots of ideas in there that we should examine.
Yeah, I just want to say so part of what you were alluding to, maybe purposefully or not purposefully, is a certain conception of, like, prison abolition. And that is a conversation that is not often necessarily at the center of this discourse. And I think it's important. So there are, as I understand it, generally two, like, ways to understand prison abolition. One is, like, there should be no prisons or jails at all. These institutions should not exist. And one is a more sort of conceptual recalibration of, like, what prisons and jails are, and that prisons and jails as they currently exist and as they operate in the capacity that they do should not exist, which is kind of similar to what I heard you saying. And you know, one thing I just, we don't have enough time to sort of, like, litigate whether prison abolition is a helpful or legitimate means of pursuing criminal justice revolution, but I think it should be at some point. But I do want to say that, you know, back in 1850, you know, if you were a slave abolitionist, people would look at you like you were crazy, right? And back, you know, Frederick Douglass is sort of universally celebrated now, and people are like, man, he was prophetic, and that he knew exactly what
he was
doing.
Such good
and, you know, he was doing such
glad
good work.
Glad he's getting
work.
More recognition.
But, like, recognized more and more. You know, he's out here somewhere in Farragut, just, like, hanging out. But, like, a lot, if you go back and read the literature at that time, a lot of people thought that abolitionists were, like, these crazy, untethered individuals who didn't. They were like, this is ridiculous. How could you say we just need to let all the slaves go? That's irresponsible. That's not politically palatable. And it's worth considering, you know, I want to be clear, I'm not making antebellum slavery and mass incarceration analogous, but it is worth considering the ways in which, like, when people, how we look back at individuals who were advocating for what at that time were seen as, like, radically irresponsible public policy initiatives, and that, then we sort of look back and we say, man, those folks were really ahead of their time. And I think, you know, sometimes people who are staunch prison abolitionists are left out. They're not even, like, invited to this room, or they're not even part of this conversation, because people look at them and say, they're not serious about this, or this is a ridiculous thing to even bring up. And I think it's just worth considering and sort of doing a understanding of the historical context and precedents that exist around questions of abolition and questions of sort of creating a blank slate, because these things have been done before, and I want to make sure that certain people are not left out of this conversation simply because we think that their ideas are not politically feasible.
Sean?
Well, I think the big opportunity for reform, behavioral science and technology. There are so many ways to handle criminal justice rather than jails and prisons. And there's so many cheaper ways and so many more effective ways that we really need to reevaluate everything. Because the prison systems we have now, we know the outcomes are horrible. I mean, anywhere from 66 to 75% within 5 years are going to go back. And there's a reason for that. You treat someone like an animal and tell them they are worthless and tell them that they are going to reoffend from the time they're arrested through their incarceration, and then their probation officer will even oftentimes act as if it's only a matter of time before you're going back. You get that long enough, you start to believe it. And so we need to reevaluate kind of from the beginning to the very end, because what we're currently doing is just not working.
Cool. Your question?
I see you. Thank you. It's a short comment, actually. Thank you very much, everybody. And Sean, you stole my point. I am an urban planner, and but also technologist, 20-some years in this country. And I think that technology can play a huge role to support not only behavioral science, but also neural science and all these studies. And if you can write a couple of algorithms for Watson to look into the discover things in the incarcerated population, one, but also in the incarcerators, because there is a dynamic relationship between the two of them. And third, into trying to find the hidden resources of this population. So you'll probably discover that 1.7 million would be a lot less after looking into, you know, using technology to get insights into this. But you could also discover, you know, my wife watches on TV religiously, the America Got Talent. Why not incarcerated America Has Talent? I bet there would be huge resources there that could be put to work. Thank you.
Yeah, and there are, and you know, there are interesting, like Piper, who wrote Orange is the New Black, which is probably why you know Piper. She helps to make sure there are TED Talks in prisons, right? Like, which is like programming that you don't often see, but it is happening across the country. You were going to say something?
To your point about the talent, I was amazed at the waste of talent in prison. There were some people that, you know, had circumstances been differently, or had they got mental health treatment or drug and alcohol treatment, they wouldn't be sitting in prison today. They would be out artists, lawyer, doctor. These are people that are no different than you. They just got caught making mistakes, many of them when they were young. And I get that a lot. I've had federal judges, federal prosecutors, police, FBI agents. They always come up to me because they always want to say, you know what, Sean, if I had got caught for some of the things I did when I was in my 20s, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be here either. And so we as a society seem to be awfully judgmental. And we should be upset about crime, but it doesn't do us any good to just be upset and angry and punish people and be mad at people and throw them away for decades at a time when most of us have done things we regret from our 20s.
Quickly, I want to say something about Sean's point. I think he's absolutely right. There, you know, the time I spent working in prison, you encounter so many people who are incredibly talented, incredibly smart. You know, you work with folks who can, you know the entire canon of Western philosophy and sort of drop Rousseau and de Tocqueville quotes. You know, like when you're, you know, I was talking about ice cream and brought up this Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But it is important for us to be careful not to make that the litmus test for whether or not someone deserves to be in prison or not. So there are brilliant, brilliant, talented people in prison, and there are people who struggle with literacy and people who have mental, learning disabilities and people who are not quoting the, you know, Western canon. And I think it is, while we have to both hold both of those things at once and recognize both that there are brilliant people whose talent is being wasted, mm-hmm. and also people who would not contribute in that sort of way to the community, but we have to recognize value. Right, that there is still value in that, and that one's value is not predicated or dependent upon, you know, whether or not they were the next Picasso or whether or not they would have been a great Wall Street banker. And so I think I just wanted to name that it's important to hold both of those at once.
Hi, I'm Samira Daniels. I've been interested in decision theory, and I see a lot of what you're saying has a lot of implications for a very broad discussion. but specifically to your comment about behavioral sciences and technology as a means of addressing some of the, you know, the issues you've raised. I've been attending a series on some of the drawbacks of the uses of technology in identifying, you know, culpability and so forth, as well as following the replication crises of, you know, those 100 studies that were, you know, were used for replication purposes. And I'm wondering whether you wouldn't have some caution about the uses of the, you know, findings in behavioral sciences, because there's a broader problem of the statistics that are used, the measurements used towards these findings. And I think that I'm a little bit worried because in even the neurosciences, the finding is that, you know, they're very sketchy and many findings are false, actually. So I just wanted to know what exactly you were driving there.
So you're talking more about predicting behavior of individual defendants using technology. That's not something I actually have thought about in great deal, and it troubles me that judges and prosecutors are using that. The behavioral science I'm talking about is even more basic than that. We know young men, 18 to 25, are the primary causes of violent crimes. We know they age out. We have the statistics. The statistics are undeniable that by the time they hit 35, 45, 55, the chance of them committing new crimes is not very great. We also know that behavioral science to deter someone, you'll hear a lot about, especially from Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, we need long sentences to deter people. I'm going to sentence you to a long sentence because then it's going to deter everyone else. Deterrence only works if you know about it. And let's think about the types of people that commit crimes. Drug addiction, alcohol addiction, mental health illness, impulse control issues, and young and immature, or all five of those in one case. These are not the people that weigh out the consequences of a long sentence. But even if they were, let me just assume that the person that has serious mental illness and is selling drugs on the corner is going to think about that day what the punishment would be before they commit the crime. They'd have to find one of 5,000 federal statutes to find the mandatory minimum and maximum punishment. Then they'd have to go to a 500-page guideline manual that, by the way, judges and lawyers misapply every day in federal court. To think that that actually happens is ludicrous. And so we know what deters people, the thought of getting caught. And you would think that everyone could get on board with, we want more policemen catching people doing crimes because that deters people, and we want less incarceration because long sentences, people don't know the punishment that they're going to face. And 11 years, I never met one person, not one person, who knew the amount of punishment they were going to face for committing a federal felony. And so that's the behavioral science I'm talking about, where we know how human beings behave and react, and yet our criminal justice policies are in opposition to that, and then we wonder why they don't work so well.
Yep. And it is important to remember to call out the way that science has been used to pathologize people of color, minorities, for centuries, right? That, yep, like black people, yep, were born to be criminals just 100 years ago, and like now, you know, we move past that in the science. So that is real. There is predictive data that is a real problem. So you think about like risk assessment. So like Khalif Browder is an interesting example, because if New York City had done what DC has done by getting rid of bail, they would have essentially replaced it with a risk assessment, and Khalif would have still been in jail. So like,
yes,
you know, that is not helpful. And you see some risk assessments ask questions like, has anybody in your family ever been incarcerated? And you're like, well, that is, you know, okay. Or like, do you live in a high crime neighborhood? You're like, well, that's a lot of people. Yeah. So those things are like real problems, and we need to make sure that we're mindful of that. I will say, from visiting jails and prisons, is that they do collect a ton of data that we're not actually using for anything. Like, I think about just the amount of data that prisons and jails collect at the intake process, like the day you get booked. The reality is that whatever is happening with you the day, like whatever attributes you have, like you probably had them the day before you got booked, right? Mm-hmm. And we should be able to figure out like how to intervene in some of these cases a little bit earlier in ways that like I'm not sure that like the system is like set up to do right now. And there's also like shockingly little data about bail. So like it's hard across the country to backtrack the like we can't look at like how a judge makes decisions around bail. It's just like really hard to find the data of like what did a defense attorney ask for, what did a prosecutor ask for, and what did a judge set. Like the data is like just not easy to find. So there are ways that we can like use technology and data to be more creative and thoughtful and precise with our solutions. Really, this time the last question is back there. I messed up on the time earlier, but this is the real last question.
Thank you for this panel. My name's Joe Hong. I write for a higher ed magazine called Diverse, covering race and equity. And I was just wondering if you could speak to the relationship between higher ed and criminal justice reform and some of the concrete steps that colleges and universities can take to contribute to reform.
Yeah, I deal with that issue a lot because everyone asks, well, Sean, what was the big thing when you got out that made a difference? And post-secondary education is the great equalizer. The more a prisoner gets out, the more education he receives, you know, the better off he's going to be, just like everyone else. But it's even more important for prisoners because going into universities is a really good community for them to get back on their feet. It's very supportive. And so I encourage a lot of universities to think more about their admissions process. And, you know, I am advising a whole lot of people with felony convictions that are on their way to currently in or recently graduated law school because we need more of that perspective in the legal profession. And so it's hugely important. I worked with this place in Seattle called the Post-Prison Education Project. And Seattle's recidivism rate was about 55%. But for the people that went through this program, and this program basically just got donations and distributed that to people coming out of prison, everything from a bus ticket to college tuition. They had people that they were funding in law school, they had someone in culinary arts, and they had someone in a welding school. That program, the recidivism rate, 2%. 2%. So post-secondary education is the great equalizer for prisoners to come out. It gives them legitimacy in the eyes of the public. It's a great community for them to be involved with. You know, you have teachers that really go to bat for you. The last thing you want to do is commit a new crime and let them down. That is the way forward for a lot of people. The problem is we need the resources and we need the universities to step up to the plate and admit more people. And there are places that are doing that. The University of Washington, where I went to law school, now is much like Ban the Box. They don't ask the question about your criminal history. And that, again, that's the way forward for a lot of people.
I would add, in a practical sense, partnerships, especially with alternative K through essentially 12 programs. So a friend of mine ran a set of alternative schools for young women, and she had come from a more traditional K through 12 background like I did. And what she said was she wasn't prepared for how many young women have the will to stay, but engaging in traditional education was not an option for them because it meant that they couldn't go earn money, right? And so if I can't go earn money in these traditional ways, right, then the temptation is to go back and earn money in ways that, like, I know aren't good for me or hook back up with people who can earn me money in those kind of ways. And so there are, so what she started to do essentially was she recognized that she needed to give those young women the opportunity to be able to work and go to school in a way that happened much more rapidly than their counterparts. So, and you know, she tried to discourage them from for-profit universities and other folks that end up preying on those kind of students for obvious reasons. But it was hard for her to find institutions of higher education that were willing to put in the resources, the time and talent to actually actualize that kind of partnership. But that's exactly what her young folks needed. They needed to be able to get those college credits, to get that advanced training, to be able to do that simultaneous with working a job, but also be able to turn that into further job and career opportunities for their families. And so I think that those kind of really practical partnerships are things that we need to see much more of.
Yeah, and I'll just say that, so when I was in Massachusetts, I was working with the Boston University Prison Project, and so that is one of the few remaining universities that, certainly in Massachusetts, but really across the country, that offer BAs and associate degrees to those who are incarcerated. There were a lot more programs that were doing that before the 1994 crime bill, which sort of decimated the educational infrastructure within prisons. And the idea was that, that you know, was propagated is why should these felons and these convicts have access to college? We shouldn't be paying for them to go to school. And despite, again, all of the evidence that demonstrated that education was one of the most effective means, the RAND Corporation did this huge study in 2013 that showed that you're 43% less likely to end up back in prison if you've participated in educational opportunities while incarcerated. You're 13% more likely to get a job after, and that number is kind of skewed because it would be a lot higher if there weren't such profound job discrimination on the workforce as we've kind of talked about and as Diva Pager talks about in her work, The Mark of a Criminal Record. But it's difficult to overstate the extent to which the 94 crime bill like really just decimated the entire landscape of education, and so many of the universities that were putting professors in a lot of these institutions simply didn't, well, they claimed they didn't have the resources anymore. There wasn't the same sort of federal or state level incentives for them to operate in these prisons, and so there are far less opportunities for prisoners to have access to college, college classes, master's classes, PhD classes, in a way that had existed before then. So part of what has to happen, you know, the Obama administration toward the end of his second term had started a pilot program around Pell Grants in prisons that we are unlikely to see continued under our current administration. And you know, these are things that when people are considering like voting and elections, like these are so much of what we talked about are like small examples of what the consequences are of certain people being in office, and I think sometimes people don't consider the totality of the landscape of executive power that exists and when we're like thinking about who to vote for, who not to vote for, or what's the same or what's different. And you know, I can just say in prisons, that is something that is felt very deeply. Especially people who have been in there for a while, they can tell you what prisons felt like before Pell Grants were stripped away and how it feels like a very different atmosphere in many of these prisons after.
And before we go, Clint, a lot of people have talked about Ban the Box and Ban the Box being a really progressive thing and a really important thing. The latest research complicates that a little bit. So I want people to hear that before we end.
Yeah. And I want to be fair. This is the research that's come out over the last few years is not specific to school. I think it's different for college admittance or universities than it is for jobs. But what some of the research that come out...
Wait, time out 1 second. So Ban the Box was about not letting employers ask about your criminal record.
Right. So there is a proverbial box upon which you are... in which many of these states make you check whether or not you have been convicted of a felony before.
I've had to do that a few times.
Right. And so it's interesting. And it is sort of understood as this bad thing. This is not helpful to those who are formerly incarcerated. If you have to constantly remind people that you were once in prison, then you know the state is continuing to punish you after you have been let out, which is not fair. And I think that is true and generally understood as something that we should try to move away from. What complicates it a bit is that some of the research that's been done as of late has suggested that in places where the box is removed, employers will simply assume that the black men, this was a specific study on black men, that the black men coming into, since they can't tell whether or not somebody is a formerly incarcerated person or not, since they didn't know, they would just begin to assume that more of the black men who were coming in applying for jobs were formerly incarcerated since they couldn't, because they had to make, in their mind, a judgment call. Well, since I don't know, I have to try and figure out if you are a former felon or if you're not. And more often than not, they would make that decision at a higher rate than they were previously. And so what would happen is that the study said that the likelihood of people who were formerly incarcerated getting a job once the box was removed had gone up a bit, right, which is the ostensible goal. But the opportunities for black men who weren't incarcerated or hadn't been incarcerated before went down in a way that that made it so that black men generally were less likely to get jobs than they were before the box was banned, right? So I think that it's important for us, there are not a lot of like neat, easy solutions to this work, and I think it's important for us to like reject or question things that look as if they are easy or look as if it's like this sort of like easy universal solution. And that's not, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that we should completely forget about ban the box. I think there's more social science and research that needs to be done across different contexts, but I think that this is an important study that helps us sort of complicate what this means and goes back to what I was saying before, that a lot of the state has a lot of responsibility, but a lot of this is going to be happening in like the private individual decisions that people make every day in their, with their small businesses, with their organizations, with their corporations. And the box will only go so far to remove biases from people.
Yeah, I don't think the box would have helped me. Well, just think about it. I don't check the box, but then when it comes resume time, there's a 10-year resume gap on mine that I would not have been able to explain other than to tell them what happened. And so, yeah, I think ban the box is important, but we sometimes pat ourselves on the back too quickly when we pass a bill, when instead maybe what we should be doing is just convincing businesses that, listen, we want you to affirmatively hire people with felony convictions and get them to agree to do that, and we would probably have better and more successful outcomes if we could.
Got it. Sean, Clint, Brittany, thank you so much for being the panel. Give them a round of applause. Thank you for being here today, and we'll see you at the Brookings again soon.